It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a bit, we'll be talking about the racial divide in the United States over the George Zimmerman trial.
But first, it's time for our nostalgia segment, where we take a look back at the people, places, and things from our past that we fondly remember.
Today, we're doing something a bit different, talking about why feeling nostalgic may actually be good for us.
John Tierney writes for the science section of the New York Times, and his piece, What is Nostalgia Good For? Quite a bit, research shows, is linked to on our Facebook page. And John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica.
Well, so the breaking news here, nostalgia is actually good for us, right? It doesn't mean that we're neurotic or depressed. It can actually be a positive, huh?
Right. For a long time, people associated it with problems. It was considered, as you say, a sign of depression. It was called an immigrant psychosis. It was, but lately, one researcher in England, Constantine Sedekides, has he was feeling nostalgic when he moved to England for his old for the University of North Carolina, where he'd been. And his colleagues said, "Well, gee, you must be depressed." But he said, "No, I feel great. I just kind of enjoy looking back." And so he started doing a lot of experiments, and they found, you know, that nostalgia, we do often use nostalgia to counteract loneliness and anxiety at tough moments, but it actually helps us a lot. It combats loneliness, anxiety. It makes people feel better afterwards. It actually, when you nostalgize about the past, it tends to make you more optimistic and more inspired about the future.
Now, how do scientists test something like this?
Well, they did it in a lot of clever ways. They analyzed, you know, stories people would tell about nostalgia. They looked through a now defunct magazine called Nostalgia and analyzed all the stories and the positive and negative elements. And they found that in general the positive elements were there. And then that they outnumbered the negative elements. That there's a certain wistfulness. We've lost that. But in general, the positive things did outnumber them. And then they did experiments in the laboratory where they would induce nostalgia by having people listen to hit songs from their youth. Or they would just have them ask them to start thinking about things. And they found that the people who nostalgized felt better afterwards, and it made them more inspired. It made them less despairing about life. You know, one kind of funny experiment where they had people read this essay that was supposedly by an Oxford philosopher saying life is meaningless and none of us matters. And so they did it two ways. First, after people read this meaningless, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre existential despair, people would tend to nostalgize more than people who had not read this. And then these people subsequently felt better than the people than others who just read the essay and didn't nostalgize. So they found that it actually did seem to ward it off. Then they also found that when people nostalgized before they read that essay, that they didn't take it as seriously. That, you know, this idea that life is meaningless, you know, it just didn't, they didn't buy the argument. Because, you know, basically, nostalgia gives us a sense of meaning in life. It makes us feel connected to our past. It makes us realize that we've had meaningful experiences. Most nostalgic memories involve yourself with someone else. There's often a problem they find in these nostalgic memories, but the problem was solved thanks to help from someone close to you. And so people have this feeling that, you know, my life has continuity, my life has meaning. And so now this worked with English students, it was done. We're not sure if it would work with gloomy French intellectuals.
Well, what's interesting then is that how come nostalgia has this bittersweet patina on it, that we think of it as falling leaves, darkening skies? Proust definitely seems like he could have been neurotic and definitely very nostalgic. Where does that come from?
Well, I mean, there is a sense of loss, but you know, most nostalgic memories tend to be about, you know, weddings and lakes and sunsets and good times you spent with people. There might have been a problem. I mean, you know, some of the nostalgic memories are about someone you lost, but... you know, Constantine was telling me one of, you know, kind of a classic story was a woman who was talking about losing her favorite aunt, and it just meant so much, and she was at her deathbed. But her aunt just said to her there, "I want you to go on with your life. Don't ever look back." And she said, that really gave me this, you know, this inspiring feeling. So even though there was that sense of loss, it is also a sense that I had this meaningful connection with my aunt, and her words continue to inspire me.
I don't know if there's research on this yet, but does our relationship with nostalgia change as we age?
Yes, they've done that research, and they've found that now it actually happens in people at all ages. They found that in children as young as seven start looking back on their Christmas presents.
I did that when I was seven.
Oh, God, it was so much better.
when I was six,
days.
Yeah.
But they find that it's fairly that it rises for people around 20 when they're leaving home, starting new jobs, facing new challenges, going off to school, and saying goodbye to their family, and so they tend to nostalgize about their youth and about their old home. Then it drops in middle age, and then it picks up again in old age, as people are facing a new transition, and they have a lot, to look back on, and as they're trying to make sense of their life, too, I think.
So if it's good for us, as it seems to be from your research or from the research that's out there that you've written about, does this mean that we should try to make space in our lives to nostalgize, to sit back and remember things?
Well, Dr. Sidikide is that, he said that since, after doing this research for a decade, he has made a big conscious effort to nostalgize more often. Now, their studies show that most people do it at least once a week and typically two or three times a week. And he recommends, two or three times a week. He says, he makes a point of doing it at a time when he needs a boost, when he's facing a challenge, or then he purposely, thinks about a nostalgic memory. And he has a couple tips about it. One is, don't compare the past to the present. He said, especially for older people who might have health problems, and that may not be so uplifting. But if you just think of it as this treasure you have, his example is in Casablanca when Humphrey Bogart says, "We'll always have Paris." Now, obviously, there's a loss there. But it's, he says it's our diamond. We'll always have that memory, and it's something to cherish.
John, what are you nostalgic for?
The science staff at the Times indulged in some nostalgic memories about science for our section there on the website, and I look back on visiting the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. I grew up somewhere in the Midwest. The Paul Bunyan statue in Minnesota. I remember that. I lived in Minneapolis, and I kind of think about going to science museums, and then I think when I go, whenever I hear a Meryl Streep's voice, I remember being at the American Museum of Natural History with my son, who was four then. And we were listening to her outside the dinosaur exhibit talking about cladograms and this Meryl Streep. And so I just hear that, and it brings me back to that moment with my son as we were learning about fossils and the tree of life. And it's just, it's a great memory. I'm not going to have that back. I'll never be four again, but it's a great memory to have.
Definitely. Yeah, I think we can relate to that. Well, thank you so much for sharing this with us today. It makes me feel good about looking back.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'll nostalgize about this in the future.
As will we all. That was science writer John Tierney. His piece on the science of nostalgia is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
And hey, when you go there, why don't you tell us what you're nostalgic for, one of your favorite memories that maybe gives you a boost at a time when you need it.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the racial divide in the United States after the George Zimmerman trial. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Well, the nation continues to react to the George Zimmerman verdict this weekend with protests, including some that turned violent in Los Angeles and Oakland.
Today, we're going to go beyond the details of the trial itself and look at the racial divide in America.
Well, joining us now is our guest, Chad Dion Lassiter. He's a professor of race relations at the University of Pennsylvania. Chad, thank you and welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what do you think the reaction to this verdict tells us about race divisions in the United States?
I don't think this verdict actually highlights the mere fact that we still have a racial divide in the United States of America. I think the racial divide has always existed within the confines of American democracy. I think one thing that this particular outcome of the verdict showed is that you had people on every side of the color line that were disappointed. And so you just did not have African Americans and people of color who were upset at the gross negligence of the murder of Trayvon Martin at the hands of George Zimmerman, but you also had a lot of whites who were upset. And so when you look around our urban cities, you look around cities in America, when you look at the rallies, you look at the protests, you look at people who were speaking out, they weren't just African American. They were Asian American, Pacific Islanders. They were Native Americans. They were Latino Americans. And they were white Americans as well.
So what does that tell you? That we don't have the racial divisions that we once had, or that, you know, maybe just the narratives are more entrenched?
I think the narratives are more entrenched. We're definitely a divided United States. We're not a United States. We're a divided United States. I oftentimes say we're the United States of denial. We had a young man who got murdered because he was none other than an African American who, for the most part, there's a stereotype, there's a myth. There are some within the society who view black males from a xenophobic lens. You hear George Zimmerman on one of the Fox networks saying that African Americans need to apologize to him. We don't want to talk about race and racism in American democracy. We skirt around the issue. So I commend WPR and you all for having this conversation, and I'm looking forward to it really being a real conversation, because adjacent to Wisconsin, not too far in Chicago, we know what the murder rates are of black males killing black males. And so I'm on every side of the color line. What happened with Trayvon Martin is a travesty, and what's happening in Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles, at the expense of black males killing black males is a travesty as well. But this is heart-wrenching. This is heart-wrenching. I work with black and Latino and white males every day, but the fear of calamity for black and brown mothers is that when their sons leave, they're not so certain that they're going to come back at the end of the day. They're going to school. They're going to work. They're not certain that their sons are going to come back, because the fear is that someone who looks like them has the potential of murdering them. And now you have the George Zimmermans of the world, and we got to be really accurate when we talk about police brutality in places like Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, Newark, Trenton, Camden.
So how do we go forward from here? I mean, it sounds like at step one, we can say we haven't conquered our issues with race in America, despite, you know, the talks we've had with President Obama as the first black president, despite some of that, and going through things together as a culture like this trial, there's still issues here. So what is the next step?
I think the first step is to back up and recognize that we're not post-racial. Because you get the first African-American president of the United States of America, we were so quick to want to be post-racial. You cannot become post-racial. You have to work on uprooting all forms of marginalization and oppression. We need to be more tolerant. We need to be less homophobic. We need to not buy into forms of Islamophobia because of what happened at 9/11, because we didn't do the same when Timothy McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma building. So I think we start with tolerance. We start with what I call race dialogue. I don't think it can come from the White House. It can't come from this president. This particular president is soft on race. And being in the confines of the Oval Office does not allow one to speak out on forms of injustice, forms of inequality, and specifically when it comes at the expense of black people. And so I think what we have to do is, as a humanity, we have to begin the hard road of having these conversations. And one of the things that I think African Americans need to recognize is that there are a lot of whites who are doing anti-racism training. Peggy McIntosh talks about white privilege. Tim Wise talks about white privilege and white supremacy. Joe Fagan talks about whiteness and unearned privilege. And so you have a lot of progressive white colleagues who speak out against, you know, white supremacy, institutional racism. So I think we start with race dialogue. We need to have that painful discussion. We need not be touchy-feely, kumbaya, we shall overcome, tiptoe through the tulips. We need to have the conversation. We need to listen to one another. It's painful at times for African Americans to hear that when a black person kills a white cop, they're silent. But when a white cop kills a black person, we're ready to protest. We're ready to rally. So we need to have these frank conversations. All life is worthy to be appreciated and embraced, no matter what your gender, no matter what your ethnicity, no matter what your religion or non-religion. I think the second thing that we can do is we need to do anti-racism training in schools, starting with middle schools up to high schools. We need to find out what it is when people say that they're racist, because there's an institutional concept of that. A lot of us engage in discriminatory behavior, bigotry, we're xenophobic, things of that nature, But we also need to recognize that it's not going to happen overnight. There has to be sustainable efforts. I've been working on anti-racism training for 20 years, and every day I get up excited about, you know, rolling up my sleeves and taking off my metaphoric cufflinks to dismantle American racism and all forms of oppression. So it's not something that happens overnight.
Now, I can remember a couple points during Barack Obama's presidency. Well, I guess one was before, when he was dealing with issues from Jeremiah Wright, his pastor. And then again, when the Henry Louis Gates situation blew up and he had, he had a little conversation with the nation, and people said, look, we're finally addressing race on a national level. And this is an important talk that we need to have as a country. And it seems as though that hasn't changed much.
No, it hasn't. And the president, with all due respect, wasted an opportunity. It was Henry Gates being confronted with the officer. To me, it had elements of race, but it, for me, was more of a masculinity contest. The officer wasn't going to give an inch. Gates wasn't going to give an inch. And the president could have called for a national dialogue on race. He called for a beer summit. And Gates had to be reminded of racial profiling because it happened to him. He was on Good Morning America, and he said, you know, I never knew that, you know, racial profiling actually occurred. And it's like, what world are you living in? I think the closest we've had with regards to a conversation, an earnest and frank conversation on race, occurred under the Clinton administration, where he put together and convened a race commission that was spearheaded by John Hope Franklin, who's now deceased, who was professor emeritus at Duke University. But even then, we didn't use words like race and racism. It was the problem that divides Americans. And then with regards to the race speech that President Obama gave here in my hometown of Philadelphia at the National Constitution Center against the backdrop of all the challenges with Reverend Jeremiah Wright, strong speech, a lot of symbolism, very visceral for a lot of Americans, but didn't do anything to serve as a catalyst and a jumping off point for us to have the type of conversation that we're having now. But we also must say that in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, and our synagogues, and our churches, and our masjids, that people are having conversations around racism, the ACLU, Anti-Defamation League. There's a lot of anti-racist programs that happen and are occurring simultaneously well before Trayvon Martin. And so I'm encouraged that we can have this conversation, but I believe that racism is permanent, and I don't think it ever goes away. I think it just changes its stripes like a chameleon, but I'm still encouraged that every day, if you're committed to fighting and dismantling all forms of oppression and marginalization, then you become a prisoner of hope.
You think racism is permanent?
Oh, yes.
When you say something like that, you know, it's hard to go forward, because it would be nice to see, after this verdict with Zimmerman, that at least we've been shown where the fault lines are, so we can point to it, and everyone has to kind of cop to feeling uncomfortable about this, and that a dialogue is needed. But when someone like you, who is a champion of overcoming racism, says it's permanent, what do we do?
Oh, I don't say I've overcome racism. If you heard what I said earlier, I prefaced it by saying I'm a prisoner of hope. So I believe that racism is permanent, but it does not mean that you don't get up every day and try to fight it. Martin Luther King, he fought it. Gandhi, he fought it. Mother Teresa did things around bigotry and discrimination as it related to people who were suffering from leprosy. Princess Di did things over in Africa. So when President Jimmy Carter. So when I say it's permanent, that's not something that we should frown upon. It's just my reality. This is a 400-year protracted struggle for people of color in America. We can remember not too long ago when, in the 60s, certain hospitals had W for white blood, C for colored blood, the bus boycott, housing discrimination. Amadou Diallo went into his wallet up in New York to show that he was not illegal, but he was, in fact, had papers and was not an illegal immigrant, and got shot 41 times in his doorway. That does not happen to certain white males. You know, and that's the reality for a lot of black and brown males in the society. You know, they get a pass. There's a Columbine. There's the young man who was under a lot of pressure with his PhD and went into the movie theater. We talk about how he met with his therapist. They get biopsychosocial assessments, mental status exam. Black and brown individuals who commit crime, we don't give them a pass. We label them as uncivilized. That's a historical thing. Nowhere in the history of American democracy have you ever had a systematic group of black people who have burned churches, desecrated synagogues. You know, there's never been a black Ku Klux Klan lynch white people, killed white people, but that has happened to black people.
And we'll have to pause there as we head to our break. We're talking with Chad Dion Lassiter, professor of race relations at the University of Pennsylvania. Love to get you in on this. What's your take? 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We have a check of the latest headlines, and we'll also go on and talk about race with our guest, Chad Dion Lassiter. And we have lots of calls going on here. We have Bruce in Madison.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Bruce.
My comment is essentially this. It's something that I grew up with and actually something I use in managing people I work with. And that is that if somebody has a negative perception of you as either an individual or a group, it is, and you don't like that perception of you, then it is up to you to change so that your perception is different. I.e., you can't just ask people to accept what I do and look at me differently. And I find that in many groups, and it's not just black or Hispanic, it's different groups. If there's a negative perception out there, then those who are viewed negatively need to recognize that and change.
So Bruce, putting the onus on the change on the group that has the misperceptions about them. What do you think about that, Chad?
I disagree. That's like saying that the person who's being oppressed should say to the oppressor to stop oppressing me. I'm 6'6", African-American. I wear suits every day, except for Saturday and Sunday. Stereotypes exist about African-American men. I can come out of a meeting. I'm on the Board of Trustees, Philadelphia Prison. I'm on the Board of Trustees, the Community College of Philadelphia. I can come out of a meeting, walk to my car, and white women will clutch their purses. It's a misperception. How am I going to change that misperception that the larger society has with regards to black men, brown men, and others?
All right. Well,
I just don't understand that.
I thank you for your call, Bruce. And let's move next to Steve in Danbury. Hey, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was glad that the professor said that reaction to this didn't divide along purely racial lines. I'm a white guy living in rural northern Wisconsin, and I was absolutely appalled by the verdict. And I think, I talked a little bit to your screener about I don't know if this was purely about race or not. I think you've been kind of promoing this show all day long as about the racial divide in this country, and yet I think reaction to this verdict, if that's what we're talking about, was not along racial lines at all, and was maybe more about the idiocy of the Stand Your Ground law and the notion that an unarmed African-American male couldn't walk safely from point A to point B without being harassed, accosted, and eventually shot.
I agree with you, and I think that's the challenge that we have in our society, is that there tends to be, and I don't want to generalize and stereotype, but there tends to be some African-Americans who fundamentally and firmly believe that there are not whites out there who have a moral compass, a moral imperative, and who think the same way that they think with regards to certain travesties. Just like in the white America, there are some who believe that African-Americans were gloating at the fact that O.J. Simpson got off for killing Nicole Brown Simpson. Black people were not gloating that O.J. Simpson got off killing Nicole Brown Simpson. We fundamentally knew that he killed Nicole Brown Simpson based on the preponderance of the evidence. What you saw was African-Americans, some, who were excited that here's a black man in American democracy who used the criminal justice system to his benefits like others have. And so I'm glad that the caller mentions that it's not always about race, because that's what happens. The media likes to seduce us into race, and then you have African-Americans who, for most of them, are quiet. I read an article that said between the shooting and the verdict, it was 513 days between the shooting and the verdict, 11,106 blacks were killed by other blacks. And so we have George Zimmerman's and our communities, and we have this quote-unquote no snitch policy. And so we have to also push that paradigm. Let's rally against George Zimmerman, and let's protest. But what about in Chicago where black males are killing black males? I understand it's against the backdrop of unemployment, underemployment, institutional racism, but it's also something that we don't talk about, which is black victimization. Everything is not tied into institutional racism. Nevertheless, we don't want to use black-on-black crime as a distraction for what we're talking about here today, which is it wasn't a jury of his peers. You had a woman refer to him who was one of the jurors as that boy. You had George Zimmerman who looked at Trayvon Martin being in a hoodie, coming back in a gated community. The racial contract tells us that in a gated community is demarcated by space. So in Zimmerman's mind, he was not supposed to be in that gated community. So whether he had marijuana in his system, he could have had a perfect score on his ACTs, SATs on his way to Dartmouth. He did not deserve to get killed. So even in his death, we blame him as being the aggressor, and he's the one that died.
So, Professor Lesser, I want to ask you, do you agree with Steve, our caller, that maybe there is some encouragement in the reaction to the verdict here that it didn't break down along racial lines exactly?
I think Steve just echoed the same sentiments that I opened the show with, is that I don't think it was about, you know, a racial divide, because, once again, humanity was out there rallying and protesting. You had black, brown, white coming together as a rainbow coalition who did not agree with that verdict. And we also have to lend pause. For those who agree with the verdict, we have to respect them as well. That's where the tolerance comes in. There are some people who saw Zimmerman as racist and a white supremacist who targeted Trayvon Martin through racial profiling. There are some who looked at Trayvon Martin as the aggressor. And so we have to respect opinions, and we can disagree in an agreeable manner. So, you know, kudos to Steve. You know, Steve is absolutely right. You know, but there's a certain degree of media sensationalism around being racialized in a racialized state that gets us glued to the TV, MSNBC, CNN. We get caught up in Rachel Gentile and the way she had an attitude. Let's move ourselves beyond the imagery and her articulation or her how linguistically challenged she was, and let's look at what she actually was saying with regards to her friend Trayvon Martin, who's now deceased at the hands of George Zimmerman.
All right. Well, I want to thank Steve for that call and go next to Kelly in Milwaukee for a quick call. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, actually, just as I was listening now, I have another question for the guest. You know, I was talking among family and friends, and it seems like, and it sounds strange to say, but it seems like since Obama, which as an African-American, we thought there's some hope there, it almost seems like there's been a backfire that now racism is much more on the surface now. It's like, okay, this happened. We elected him again, and now we can be mad. I just feel, and I know that you're saying let's not talk about race, but I just have a sense like things have gotten worse since Obama, and that was supposed to be our hope. I don't know if that makes sense, but
no, it makes perfect sense, Kelly. And let me just as a disclaimer say I'm okay with talking about race. I'm very comfortable. This is what I do. I think what we saw when Barack Obama he was running for president of the United States, and then he became president of the United States, what we also saw was the questioning of black humanity by white male individuals who benefit from white male privilege, that he's the birther movement. We need to see his birth certificate. We need to see his transcripts from Columbia and Harvard University, the questioning of black intelligence. It's a continuous thing. And then he becomes the president, and then he gets reelected. And you have individuals, when he ran the first time and became president, who vehemently said that their job is to make him a one-term president. And so, yes, we get the first African-American president of the United States. And, Kelly, we see more hate. The Secret Service has received more death threats. We see more individuals like Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and others who is just open season on people of color, specifically African Americans. And that's what America has to come to grips with, is that when we say that we're not a racist country, there are elements of our country that is racist. And that's hard for people who are into patriotism. But Martin Luther King loved America enough to tell America about itself, and he did it with love. His greatest speech was A Time to Break Silence, why I opposed the Vietnam War. And King was born on American soil, and he loved America. And so the greatest crime, or the we look at slavery and we say that's the greatest sin. It's the greatest crime against humanity, what we've done to the Native Americans. But it's still one of the greatest countries on the face of the earth. So, Kelly, what you and your family and your colleagues are seeing is we're seeing people who don't know how to articulate their frustration because they look at him and they say, I should be the president. And that's what some of these politicians are doing. When someone stands up at the State of the Union address and says, you lie, that's akin to just shut the hell up. And that did not happen to any other president but Barack Obama.
And we have to leave it there. Professor Lassiter, thank you so much for joining us. It was good to talk to you today.
Thank you for having me, and God bless America.
We were speaking with Chad Dion Lassiter, professor of race relations at the University of Pennsylvania.
Coming up, we'll talk about the decline, a possible decline of retail jobs, ups and downs in the industry, but are there just fewer jobs out there in the future? I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
The retail industry is always in flux, some chains closing, others moving in to take their place. But we saw a recent article in The Atlantic making the case that retail jobs are on the decline.
We called up Nancy Kane with the Harvard Business School. She's been studying the retail world for a good long time. Nancy, thank you for joining us today.
A pleasure, Rob.
Well, is this Atlantic article we saw right? Are retail jobs on a long-term decline?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I know that it's very seductive and, you know, at first blush makes a lot of sense to compare this to farming or manufacturing. But, and, you know, and certainly, right, there is Schumpeter's creative destruction at work in all three of those industries, like there is in, you know, the smartphone industry and many others. But I think that what's going on in retail right now is that a whole bunch of companies that, you know, succeeded, say, you know, in the middle and later part of the 20th century have crested and haven't found, you know, enough innovation or enough relevance or enough efficiency or all three to compete effectively in the early 21st century. So, yes, JCPenney is, you know, is moribund. I don't think they're out. I mean, I think, you know, if anything, Ron Johnson's ill-fated short tenure at Penny shows that the core of the brand is still alive and still robust. He didn't honor it, and that's part of the reason the chain suffered so much. And yes, you know, Walmart works more efficiently, and so when it moves into a county, it often causes a net job loss in retail because Walmart puts smaller shops out of business. But I don't think those two canaries down the mine shaft, if you will, are the whole story. If you think about a lot of companies, retail companies are doing very well, they're actually hiring people. Starbucks is hiring people. Lululemon is hiring people. All the wireless stores, Verizon, AT&T, et cetera, are hiring people. 7-Eleven is growing like gangbusters, and they're hiring people because retail is a labor-intensive business. So there are some 16 million Americans that work, often, you know, part-time in that industry. And we're not going to be able to buy everything online, right, in a much less labor-intensive kind of enterprise, no matter what happens to technology. So I'm not lying awake at night worrying that this labor-intensive, job-demanding sector is on some kind of dramatic decline.
But you mentioned Walmart's, and it seems like they're one of the companies at the forefront of using some technology, at least, to get more work with fewer people. Is that something that's at least leading to that net decline in retail jobs when they open up in an area?
No question. You know, that's a fundamental dynamic in capitalism, right? If you think about textile industries or think about lots of different kinds of manufacturing industries, those places gravitate to two different destinations. One, technology-driven production techniques that lower labor costs, which are often net-net, you know, more expensive, fully loaded than technology is, even after you've invested in it, or destinations like the textile industry where labor is simply very, very cheap relative to other countries. So a fundamental driver in, you know, Schumpeter's creative destruction and capitalism that undergirds it is how do we get labor costs down? And that often means, you know, gravitating to techniques or industries that use less labor. there's no question that's going on. But is retail itself, as a labor-demanding enterprise, you know, gasping its last breath? I don't think so. If only because we see, you know, in this wonderfully vibrant way, you know, the startup, the continuous startup of new businesses, right? I mean, 10 years ago, who would have expected, say, for example, that a whole bunch of wealthy and upper middle class women would start buying expensive, you know, athletic wear at a place called Lululemon, and that would become its own kind of, you know, engine of growth. That's a very labor intensive enterprise, and they hire lots and lots of people. I mean, who would have thought that Chico's or 7-Eleven, you know, brands that have been around for a long time, would grow upwards of 15-20% last year, and again, hire people to fund that growth. You know, GNC sells vitamins and supplements. That business grew something like 15% last year. They hired a bunch of people to go in their shops, just like the folks at Vitamin Shop. So the really nifty thing, the sexy and sizzly thing about retail is that it's a bellwether of what's going on in the consumer economy, right? It reflects what's less interesting to consumers and what's more interesting. And the first, if you will, soldiers on the beach in any new sector of consumer demand are always stores, and stores are populated by people. So are these going to be high paying, you know, benefits providing middle class jobs? No, they've rarely ever been. But are they going to vanish, or in some sense really suck down our already shaky employment numbers and increase our already high unemployment numbers? I don't think so. I looked this up before I talked to you folks. I looked up the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers on retail. Believe it or not, retail unemployment has fallen, almost 10% since March of 2013. It's now at 7.3%, quite a bit below the national average. So that suggests that stores, or the businesses that supply stores are actually adding people rather than losing them right now.
And now, of course, we just came through and are hopefully out of a big long recession. Is that something that shook out a lot of businesses, and now the ones that are still around are seeing a lot of opportunity for growth?
Yes, it did. It did. It did a couple of things. It drastically cut, you know, store numbers in many businesses. And we're still seeing reverb from that, Rob. Think about Barnes and Noble talking about shutting stores, or Kmart shutting stores. So yes, it shook out, you know, chains that had too many stores per, you know, if you will, viable consuming population. And it created areas, empty places in the market as businesses closed, where new business could arise. And, you know, that's the ecosystem part of capitalism, right? Right? Things die and other things come into their place, not costlessly, right? This is, the things I'm talking about are expensive because they mean people lose livelihoods and people, in some cases, lose benefits, and families and individuals and communities depend on them. So this is not costless. It's a big deal in terms of transition costs, and it's human costs. But again, I think that the sector itself, as a demander, as a magnet for labor, will continue to be that. Again, mostly on a part-time basis and not fully loaded, great middle-class jobs, but certainly places, right, where think of all those 200,000 Starbucks employees, many of whom work 22 hours a week so they can get health care benefits, right? Anything over 20, they get good health care benefits, but also so they can supplement a technology job or an artist job or a job as a home health care aide where they don't get benefits. So we're seeing increasingly, and this to me is the most interesting thing about this phenomenon, we're seeing an economy emerge, heavily service-oriented economy, in which individuals increasingly in this country and around the world will become their own entrepreneurial, if you will, career setters. And some of that's going to be a real adjustment for an economy that grew up on, you know, Darren Stevens in Bewitched climbing the ladder at his ad agency, or the man in the gray flannel suit. But a lot of it will be great opportunities for people with initiative, with creativity, and with the use of technology to go out and find a job or a set of jobs at one time that suits what they want to do and pays them what they want to earn in terms of money and in terms of skills and knowledge.
Well, what I wonder is if, say, a factory shuts down and a software company opens up, if I'm working at that factory, so what? I don't have those software skills. It's going to take me 4 years to acquire them.
Absolutely.
If Kmart closes and a new retail chain, Costco, say, comes in, maybe my skills translate a little faster.
Maybe. may be. You know, this is, we're in the early days of this yet, right? And most of the policymaking and the talking heads around this issue has been looking backwards and saying, why doesn't America have what it had, you know, 20 years ago? But maybe the question is different. Maybe the question is, what can we put together community by community that allows enough opportunity, including on a telecommuting basis or on a mix of part-time basis, that supplies people with a decent living and decent health care, and most as important as either of those two, a sense of dignity and satisfaction about what they're doing and where they're headed. But it will not be corporations that in a large scale way do this as we thought about them doing it for many, many years. It will be individuals. It will be individuals saying, I'm willing to retrain, I'm willing to put piece things together. And again, we should take our cues. I say this, we being a late baby boomer, we can take our cues from millennials, right? The people in their early 20s who think about it this way, whatever their education level, whatever their skill level, what's the next job I need to make me bigger, make me better, so I can get on the road that I see as my best destiny?
I'm going to wrap up with not much time and a huge question for you. This kind of nags at me sometimes. We look at, okay, the normal in the 50s, I worked my way up the ladder, like you mentioned, and I retired from the company I started with out of college or out of high school, and now things are getting weird. Well, I'm wondering, was that the weird thing? Was that the aberration? And and not that is the normal, the old and the new normal?
Maybe. That's a really, really good question, because the years of the industrial social contract, whether we're talking about General Motors, whether we're talking about an advertising agency, whether we're talking about working for Time or, you know, some big law firm or a hospital, right, before the white-hot turbulence of healthcare today, you know, that social contract is, as you suggest, Rob, an anomaly in the sweep of capitalistic history. It's an anomaly relative to other countries. It existed around the world for about 70 years. But it never existed before that, you know, for 100 years before that of industrialization. And it doesn't look like it's coming back in that form anytime soon. So maybe we're all looking at a back to the future kind of thing, where we're going backwards to learn about being our own journeymen or our own journeywomen, with some savvy and some skills and some curiosity and some flexibility. And so, high standards.
So all we have to do is completely change our expectations, legal systems, and labor system, and we're home free.
Well, I'm not sure that the latter two will take so much.
Gotcha.
Think the bigger challenge is the first one.
Great.
How do we find the right frame to demand what we must demand of our polity, and then to demand what we must demand of ourselves?
Nancy,
thank
you so much for joining us today. I appreciate
it. Real pleasure.
That was Nancy Kane with Harvard Business School.
A new tattoo exhibit opened this month at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We're going to be talking about tattoos as art and find out what tattoos mean to you. That's coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.